Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another Quarantstream edition of The Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely these days by my co-host Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. And Charlie, I think this should be a relatively quick podcast since there's one big movie coming out theatrically this week. And I don't know, tell me, Charlie, should anyone risk their lives to go see The War with Grandpa?
No, unless you want to kill Grandpa, take him with you. But I don't know how anyone's going to see this in a theater. Cineworld, the owner of Regal, maybe you've heard of it, is closing theaters again. I mean, I don't know how you're going to see this in a theater unless you're in one of those states that doesn't believe in the pandemic anyway. But The War with Grandpa is, I'll just go ahead and spoil it, garbage. Apparently, it is based on this popular young adult novel I have never heard of. It came out in 1984, and I already feel bad for saying it because the author, Robert Kimball Smith, passed away this April. I apologize, I'm sorry, but I'd never heard of this book that sold 1.5 million copies. Maybe it reads better on the page, but on screen, you have an 11-year-old, Oakes Fegley. We've seen him before. He was Pete in Pete's Dragon. That's pretty cool. He was good. And De Niro. I think we've heard of him before, too. This is how De Niro chooses to follow up The Irishman, by the way. And you know what? He was probably mad. It didn't get any awards. It was nominated for everything. Didn't win anything. And he says, all right, you, fine. You get the war with Grandpa if this is how you're going to treat me. Grandpa's getting old. He's fighting with the self-checkout machine. He's losing his driving ability. So instead of putting him in an assisted living facility, he moves in with his daughter and son-in-law and three kids in a cramped house and busy lives, therefore kicking the 11-year-old boy up to the rodent and bat-infested attic, where instead of really just talking it out, which Grandpa, to his credit, tries to do, he declares prank war. And so you really get 90 minutes of prank war, an unexpected, almost borderline, used to be A-list casting. Mama's Uma Thurman. I mean, we already got De Niro here, but Mama's Uma Thurman. Kill Bill. Dad is Rob Riggle. Okay, he belongs here. Fair enough. And De Niro's cohorts, his gang, Christopher Walken, Oscar winner Christopher Walken, Jane Seymour. She's a Bond girl. She also played a medicine woman at one time. And Cheech Marin. He belongs here, too. So Cheech Marin and Rob Riggle, you can stay. Everybody else, what are you doing? This, you don't laugh. It's not funny. These are not pranks that are well thought out and long-running and properly set up and sell with punchlines. These are Q-list pratfalls, slapstick, ouch, you hit me in my nether region kind of pranks. And you know, it makes fun of all people. I think it's... Yes, it's geared towards 10-year-olds. Anyone higher than that's really not going to find this funny either. I didn't let my son watch it because it's a little edgy at times. And the seniors are certainly not going to watch it because not only is it making fun of them, it's not funny to them either. So who this is made for, I don't know. Why it's so well cast, I don't know. Why it was made at all, you tell me, Hannah.
Well, I never read the book either and was not aware of the book, but I agree with you. I think it probably was better on the written page than it translated into a screenplay. Because I think what happened is that the ultimate cutting of this film undermined whatever performances you might have gotten out of this pretty A-list cast. I also felt very old to see Jane Seymour playing sort of this store clerk who becomes Robert De Niro's love interest. I was like, oh man, that is just, that hurts. That was disappointing. But it's probably only for the 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds who maybe watch it with their parents and grandparents. I think it's meant to be an intergenerational, family-friendly film. But it's dull. That was the thing that I found, is that it has a few funny moments, a few sweet moments, But for the most part, it's this very paint by the numbers kind of thing. The only, you know, it's got the, it was pretty funny. You had a game of dodgeball and they called them like the age appropriate team versus the AARP team. And you know exactly how that game is going to play out. It's more of a, this is Meet the Parents De Niro, only not as well written of a role, but that's the kind of character that he's playing. And so it's not that we haven't seen De Niro in this kind of role before. I did not see Dirty Grandpa that he was in with Zac Efron. So I think it's kind of funny. I figure it's kind of funny that you had the R-rated Dirty Grandpa, and now you have the PG-rated War with Grandpa. Whether or not one or the other is worth seeing, I don't know. I'm guessing that maybe this would show up in some drive-in somewhere theater. And so if the whole family wanted to just pack into the car and kill 90 minutes, then the War with Grandpa might be something that they'd go see. But I can't really recommend it. It was ridiculously predictable. I felt like there were definitely loose ends with the character and the story. I hated the ending. The ending to me was just terrible. I do feel like things were left on the cutting room floor to make it a 90-minute film. And so in the end, I think they cut out some character development and story. So who knows what happened there. But then they try to have it be sort of a bit of a message movie. You know, about the fine line between love and war and how war is not a game and it hurts and it can cause misery. And so I think that they were just trying to do a whole bunch of different things with this movie. And it's just not very funny. And it moves. And it, again, just dull.
Directed by Tim Hill, known for one of the Alvin and the Chipmunks films and one of the Garfield films. So, you know, it's directed by a guy you thought it would be directed by, but this is going to fall in that category of, oh man, there was that forgettable kid movie. Remember a few years ago, they made a film out of Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, a beloved children's book, and nobody remembers that movie. Mr. Popper's Penguins with Jim Carrey. Nobody remembers that movie. In fact, they probably just remember it for being bad, and they've made a couple Diary of a Wimpy Kid movies. That's more for contemporary children, because those are relatively contemporary children's books, but nobody is talking about those movies because they are just not making high quality, stick around, make you think, make you talk cinema. They're just spewing these out. Hopefully one of them latches on and makes Hollywood a couple bucks. And that is once again my cynical yet very realistic take.
And it would have been a not so cynical take, or much more realistic of a take, if this were normal times. People would go see, I do think that families would go see this movie in the theater under normal circumstances when there hasn't really been much else in terms of just family-friendly fare to go and see for that age group. And De Niro would have been enough of a draw. You know, I think people would have, you know, Oakes Fegley is really good. He was also in Wonderstruck and The Goldfinch. You know, so he's a good up-and-coming actor from that age range. And so I think it might have done okay if this were theatrically released in any other year, but it is just not something that anyone should go into a theater to see.
No, it's not. Even if there was no COVID, I would say no, but even with the real threat of COVID, Lord, no. And I'm not even saying go see a movie in a theater if you're sure it's the Best Picture Oscar winner. Still don't go, but damn sure don't go to this one.
Yeah, no, I agree. So I think the best avenue is for people to just sort of stick with whatever they might have missed before that's streaming, or new things that are streaming. And I think you saw one of the latest offerings on Netflix.
I saw the one that's already, it came out on Wednesday, and it's already number one. It's going to be number one probably close to Halloween, because it's a Halloween film, Hubie Halloween. This is part of that make Adam Sandler even more obscenely rich than he already is Netflix deal to make terrible films. And Hubie Halloween is no different. It's not your standard R-rated Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore. It's technically for children. I think it's PG or PG-13. But, all right, let's talk about why it stinks. So Adam Sandler plays Hubie Dubois. Hubie Dubois is very similar, if you remember 1998's The Waterboy, where he played Bobby Boucher. Bobby Boucher, who wanted to play the foosball, but Mama, played by Kathy Bates, didn't want to play the foosball. Hubie Dubois has a very similar, very low growl, guttural, mumbly voice. It's almost hard to understand him. And he almost plays him mentally challenged, which is very strange. Hubie is not mentally challenged, but he almost comes off that way. And it's halfway unsettling to see that. Hubie Dubois is Salem, Massachusetts' self-appointed protector. He's, you know, your volunteer hall monitor, crossing guard, guy who rides around the town on a bicycle looking for ne'er-do-wells. And you can imagine how popular that makes him, both with the adults and the children. They just throw things at him on the street while he pedals by, and that's supposed to be serious comedy. Mom is now played by June Squibb. We remember her from Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
She wears shirts that she doesn't understand, but, one of them's called, Boner Donor. and the cavalcade, the roster of Adam Sandler film acolytes are here. Kevin James is here. Steve Buscemi, he goes all the way back to Billy Madison, Rob Schneider, and a whole bunch of other Saturday Night Live alums. Maya Rudolph, Tim Meadows, Kenan Thompson, Mikey Day, Melissa Villaseñor. I mean, and there are some cameos here I'm not going to give away. I know there's a good chance you're going to get stuck watching this, because if you give the child the remote or I'm just want to watch what's number one on Netflix, you're going to end up seeing this, and there are a couple cameos that are so, whoa, that person's here. I won't give it away. It's Halloween. Halloween in Salem, Massachusetts apparently is a big deal. Hubie's ancestor, great-great-great whatever, was, burned at the stake as a witch trying to protect women accused as witches. So he carries on the line of being a protector, and he's catching on to something. There's wind of an escaped mental patient who may have returned to Salem, Massachusetts. There's rumor of a werewolf. He sees kids buying eggs and toilet paper. I mean, he's got his hackles up, and he's ready to save Halloween and make sure everyone gets home on time. He's got a love interest, Julie Bowen. You remember her from Modern Family? Her name's Violet Valentine. In The Waterboy, his love interest was Vicki Vallencourt. I love how they're really stretching to make these original screenplays here, written by the same guy, by the way. Hubie Halloween, it won't hurt you. You might even chuckle once, not twice. It's terrible. It's right up there if you had to sit through The Do-Over or Sandy Wexler. It makes you just wonder, really? You did Uncut Gems and went back to this, brother? Come on,
well,
Adam.
Come on. We've seen Adam Sandler has his deal with Netflix, and they always do really well. And you know what you're getting with those movies.
Doesn't make it right.
But it makes it comfortable. It's easy.
Yes, people will watch it because it's so easy. It's right there. It's the biggest icon on the screen, and you've seen Adam Sandler before. And I've heard of Vicki Vallencourt. Let me watch Violet Valentine. I'm very comfortable with the known, and I know all these little supporting characters because I remember them in that skit once on SNL. Yes, it's so known that it hurts.
I think it hurts you more than it will hurt the average Netflix viewer, which is why, that it's trending on Netflix, as is. Talk about a shift in tone, though. The Netflix trending film that got me this week was American Murder, The Family Next Door.
Ew, and that's, I don't even like that title.
True crime documentary on Netflix that my brothers had alerted me to. They watched it. So it's definitely, it's trending high on Netflix because it is so engrossing and horrifying and just, it's true. And that's what's so freaking scary about the whole thing is it's about, I think people will remember as soon as you get the initial overview of this story. It's about the disappearance and murder of Shannon Watts and her two little girls in Colorado in 2018. And she was pregnant with her third child at the time with husband Chris Watts. And it was later revealed that Chris was having an affair and he had killed his entire family buried his wife and put his daughters in oil tanks in at his remote work location. And so this is one of those sort of Dateline-ish kind of things.
Why would you watch that?
Because what makes it just so fascinating to watch is it's put together entirely with existing footage. So there's no voiceover. There's no narration. You are seeing this compilation of social media that Shannon Watts had put out there because she was very, she was like an advocate for lupus, I think, was an illness that she was suffering with. And so she had a following and was very big on social media. Her texts, they had all of her phone texts between she and her husband and between her and friends. And so you get a huge part of the story from that. It's based on documentation, body camera footage, footage from neighbors. And I mean, it's just all put together that way. And you just, even though you know how it ends, you are just seeing how just you can be just amazed at how somebody can be leading a double life. And you wonder how somebody who seemed like this picture perfect loving dad could do that to his wife and children. And this was not like there was no discord that you would see between, certainly not between him and his kids. Like, he loved his kids. They adored him. And it just unfolds in this way that you are just mesmerized by the fact that they could gather, you know, the police interviews, his confession, just all this stuff that just plays out and draws you in. And so that's why it's number one, is everybody who watches it just goes, wow, that was just like watching, you're just watching a train wreck, and you just keep your eyes on it and just seeing how this happened and wondering how could somebody be just have just cracked the way that, that he did. And so I'm sure there's more to the story because it had to take a certain perspective, and he was, you know, convicted and is, I think he's, you know, he's in prison for life. But yeah, it just is just one of those word of mouth spreading kind of things where you just are absorbed. And if you do start watching, it's very hard to stop.
I want nothing to do with that.
Yeah. I was not going to recommend it to you, but I think anybody who does start watching, who likes like a true crime series, or you know, listens to the true crime podcasts and things like that, they definitely will watch this one and enjoy it for the horror story that it is. It is a true American horror story.
You know, thank you for the transition. I watched episode one of season four of a series, Fargo. I'd never seen seasons one through three, and this is one of those series that you can just jump in on. It's like an American Horror Story. They're all different. Fargo being based on the Coen brothers film. But this time, this season's based in Kansas City between rival gangs headed by Chris Rock and Jason Schwartzman. Your girl Jessie Buckley shows up. She's the only one with a Minnesota accent. Ben Whishaw. I mean, there's a lot of famous names in this show. Unlike like Utopia, which I've talked about recently, I might stick this show out. It's got that wry, could go anywhere, anyone could die at any moment, just absurdist kind of material that Fargo, the Coen brothers have. So I'm going to stick this one out for a little while, I think.
Well, since you mentioned Fargo, it brings me to the Middleburg Film Festival that we normally would be going to this time of year, one of our favorites. It is starting next week. And I think they're opening with this film, Nomadland, with Frances McDormand, who was in the Fargo movie. And I think she's getting a lot of Oscar buzz already for her role in Nomadland, which unfortunately neither of us will see because I believe they're only showing that one on site. They're having sort of a drive-in in a big field outside of the Salamander Resort in Middleburg, Virginia, that we would normally go to. So that's one of the big ones that I'm really sad to be missing this year. But they are offering up the virtual version of the film festival for those of us that you know, that don't live in Middleburg and can't be socially distanced at the outdoor drive-in. But there are a couple of on the slate that I definitely want to check out. There's Concrete Cowboy, which is a Western with Idris Elba. There's One Night in Miami, a drama directed by Regina King about a night where Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown all sit around talking about their roles in the civil rights movement. There's a Billie Holiday documentary. And then one of the things that I will most miss is those in-person chats with filmmakers. And they are going to have a virtual opportunity to see this conversation with Aaron Sorkin, which I hope to watch. And there's also the annual tribute to a composer. And this year they're celebrating Chris Bowers, who scored Green Book and a slew of other TV and movie projects. So I'm going to try and get my little dose of Middleburg during this coming week.
Yeah, I look forward to Middleburg all year. I just love that little town. And since it's in October, the leaves are always changing. I'm wearing sweaters again, and I always stay somewhere interesting. Last year, we discussed I stayed at my Civil War battlefield ghost house. This year, I already did a virtual film festival with AFI Docs, and it was okay. You know, it was okay. I didn't like the Q&As at the end. They were always a little choppy. It just doesn't compare to an in-person Q&A. And I'm skipping. 2020's already ruined. Everything's ruined. So I really don't want anything to do with Middleburg this year. You're just going to have to, you're going to carry the weight on this one.
I'm trying to salvage 2020, and so this is one of my small ways to attempt to salvage the movie season and to also get a little bit ahead of the game. I suspect you'll be able to watch screeners of all these films as they do roll out. But, you know, for me, part of Middleburg is about trying to get just a jump on all those films that will roll out towards the end of the year. Assuming they still do, that's going to be really tricky to see if these awards contenders really do come out and whether they gain any kind of traction at all as we head into the award season.
Yeah, it was just this time last year that Parasite kicked off the Middleburg Film Festival as the first film, but they're going to have a tall order. They're going to have to compete with Hubie Halloween. So good luck to them.
And anyone who does, and Grandpa.
But you mentioned, I am very sad I'm going to miss the composer section. You know, last year was Terrence Blanchard, who's known as Spike Lee's composer, and he's gonna have a big run this year. He composed Da Five Bloods, one of my favorite films of the year so far, and you know, orchestrated a wonderful score. But speaking of music, the music industry lost a legend this week, a giant, and I just wanted to pay a little homage to him. So I went on IMDb because I wanted to check, you know, maybe Eddie Van Halen had, you know, spot cameos in a film maybe that I forgot. And not really. Every now and then he voiced an animated character, but almost all of his credits are, you know, music videos. And then I looked at what his songs were licensed for, and you would imagine that Jump would have been the most licensed, and there were some, but actually it was Panama. Panama jumped out as by far, it seems, the most licensed song from his catalog. And I wonder if it's because it's probably the second most expensive. Jump's probably really expensive to license. And I also saw it last year on an episode of Family Guy where he just blares it going down the interstate before it puts him in a coma. So rest in peace, Eddie Van Halen. Gonna miss you, brother.
Yeah, absolutely. Eddie Van Halen, though, was definitely more my era of rock in the 80s. And so the first one that jumped out at me was indeed Jump. And I've forgotten about Panama. And my brain always goes back to just, when he got married to Valerie Bertinelli, his ex, and had their son Wolfgang, who actually played with Eddie Van Halen later. So he's just, I did not realize how sick he was. And that was a sad sudden departure for us, and non-COVID related, and just made you remember that that people are suffering from all sorts of other things that we forget about as time goes on. But yes, rest in peace, Eddie Van Halen. You will be missed indeed. But on a happier note, we've got some interesting films, I think, beyond my watching stuff from Middleburg. I think we both will watch talk about older actors who were doing all sorts of just roles that you kind of question to some degree. I think next week we're going to talk about An Honest Thief with Liam Neeson, correct?
Yep, yep, that's on tap.
And was there anything else on tap for next week?
The Netflix, well, I believe it's already been in theaters, if you can get to one, but opening on Netflix, The Trial of the Chicago 7, which has quite the cast if you look at it.
Oh, that's right. So we mentioned that briefly last week because I saw it a while back. And yeah, so we will both be able to compare notes next week on the Chicago 7. And hopefully I will have actually maybe seen or will soon thereafter see the Aaron Sorkin dialogue from Middleburg. So that'll we'll weigh in on that as well. Alrighty. Well, until then, thanks so much for listening, everybody. As always, if you have a question or comment, we would love to hear from you. You can reach us at The Cinema Clash on Twitter or thecinemaclash.com. And please stay safe, social distance, wear a mask, and don't forget to vote.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.